Okay, well, welcome again to our last one, our pre-Christmas one, the last one of the year. And I did say last time it'd be nice if some of you had a carol to share, something that was perhaps one of the more meaningful carols to you, or you just felt had a really good message. So I'll see in a minute whether or not anyone's responded to that, or whether we're going to have a very short evening. But John, as in John Jenks, is going to start us off because he wants to share a video and maybe one or two other things about Hanukkah. So I'm handing over to John to start with.
Okay, hi everybody. Yeah, Hanukkah has just finished. It was 8 days, and not in the appointed times of the Lord, but nonetheless, Jesus was there at least one of the times mentioned in John 10, I believe. Anyway, part of the process is because there was according to tradition, a miracle of the lighting. There was a rededication of the temple after after the Maccabees had succeeded in about 400 AD in running off the Greeks, and rededicated the temple. And it was the oil and the lamp that was important. Anyway, as a result, they have a celebration, and they eat oily food or things that have oil in them. And one of them is these latkes, which are potato cakes. Well, Rose will tell you what they're made of.
Well, you'll hear it in the song. It's just potato, a bit of onion, fried in very hot oil, and very tasty indeed.
So we've got a song by a group called the Maccabees, and here we
Yeah.
go.
Don't no, it's the donuts, is it, John?
Yes,
Yes.
it's a sufganiyot, is the donuts. So Chag Sameach Hanukkah.
Thank you. Are you finished? Is that it? Right. Okay. Great. Thank you very much. That's a bouncing start to our fun-packed evening. Does anybody have a carol that they would like to share, read out to us, even without comment? We've got Jeremy coming in. That's good. Christine, maybe next. Okay. Be thinking about it. Anytime in the evening, actually, although I'm going to talk about other things, you can leap in with this. Oh, I've got someone just to bring in. Let's get Elizabeth in. Angie, is that an indication about the carol, or you've got another question, Angie?
No, it's an indication about the carol.
Right. Okay. So we go Jeremy, Christine, Angie, and then anybody else that might want to say something. Over to Jeremy.
Thank you. I started thinking I really want to talk about Hark the Herald Angels Sing. I discovered that it was written by Charles Wesley, which I guess a lot of people might know. Then I started unraveling a little bit further back, because here in Southampton, within walking distance, is where Isaac Watts was born, on Above Bar Street in Southampton. So I realised that I've got some interest in Isaac Watts, and maybe I should have chosen Joy to the World. But Isaac Watts was born in 1674. His father also was called Isaac Watts. And I didn't realise this before, because I have in Southampton, here in Southampton, gone and sat in God's House Tower, where he was Isaac Watts was incarcerated for his nonconformist Christian views. But I didn't realise that it was Isaac Watts Sr. That had been incarcerated. So this was something new to me as I started unreeling back. But the reason I was starting with Isaac Watts is because, going back before him, John Calvin apparently said for people only to sing metrical psalms. And therefore, these dissenters and these nonconformists were in trouble. And of course, Isaac Watts was in trouble when he published in 1707 his hymns, such as When I Survey the Wondrous Cross and so on. So it's a bit of a tenuous link, but I wanted a bit of Southampton. The 1707 was when Charles Wesley was born. And in 1738, he was converted in the May. And then Charles Wesley, on going to church, was inspired on the Christmas morning, listening, I think, to the bells of the churches. And he wrote a poem, which was, "Hark, how all the welkin rings, glory to the King of Kings." And welkin, as you may or may not know, is the sky or the clouds, 1700s parlance. So Charles Wesley was able in 1739 to publish his poem, and they were able to go forward in making it a hymn, because you are now free to do so. And so Charles Wesley is listed as one of those hymn writers that was able and freed up to display his creativity, despite the reservations of others. But what I hadn't really realised was that Hark the Herald Angels Sing, as we know it, was actually penned by George Whitfield, using Charles Wesley's start. So there's a Wesley-Whitfield connection in Hark the Herald Angels Sing. And the Felix Mendelssohn music that goes with it was only added in 1855, I think. So only 100 years before most of us were born, or perhaps in Malcolm's case, even less time. But 50, was it? No. So yes. Yeah, so in 1855, we've got "Hark the Herald Angels Sing," and I've got a short clip, 3.5 minutes. Paul, is it all right to play?
Yeah.
play this song. What I really, really love is, and I could put the words in the chat, couldn't I? Because the version I've got doesn't show the words, which is, I wonder if that's, so I thought I'd better put the words in the chat.
Okay, I'm not sure whether people can see the chat at the same time as when you're sharing the video, I don't know, but.
Oh, that's a thought, isn't it?
It might be, I don't know.
We'll experiment.
We will.
So in the first verse, God and sinners reconciled. I mean, some of these words are absolutely wonderful to me. Pleased as man with men to dwell, Jesus our Emmanuel. And at the end, hail the heaven-born Prince of Peace. Hail the Son, S-U-N in this case, of righteousness. Mild he lays his glory by. Born that man may no more, that men no more may die. You know it. Born to give them second birth. And one of the things I really love about this hymn is that you sing it in the in these Gothic buildings that for 1,000 years have got that heritage of what's true. And also, of course, has been had a lot of not so good stuff in it. Spoken through it, and yet there you are in these buildings singing about second birth. So marvellous. I really enjoy that, singing there or outside Waitrose or wherever into the air. So I'll just play my favourite part from King's College now. Oh, hang on, I better check that I actually did click computer sound. Just a sec, don't remember clicking computer sound. That's always a problem, isn't that? I hadn't done. Right. So this, one of the other good things about this that I quite enjoy is that King's College have got two 32-foot pipes, an open wood 32, a double, and also a 32-foot reed, which you can hear in the last note. If I was the organist, I'd be playing it all the way through the last bit. But here we go.
Thank you.
Great. Thank you very much. That's a great start. Thank you. You mentioned Isaac Watts, and one thing I've learned recently is he was a phenomenally clever man, and he wrote on all sorts of different things, and he wrote the standard text on logic, which remained for, I don't know, decades, I suppose, until others sort of caught up on it. But he wrote on philosophy, astronomy, and all sorts of things, and wrote a standard sort of mathematical logic textbook, as well as all his hymns. As you mentioned, When I Survey the Wondrous Cross, which is probably the most famous Easter hymn as well, and Joy to the World, one of the popular Christmas ones. So thank you very much. So we've got Christine and then Angie, and in fact, Sally's got something as well. I've added you to the list.
Can I just say that I'd also chosen Hark the Herald Angels Sing. So, and just because I think it's so full of truth, and it's when compared with ones like In the Bleak Midwinter, which probably wasn't in the blue. It's just yeah. fantastic words, and it's all full of biblical truth. So I've chosen the same one. So
okay. Was there anything else you wanted to add about it? Did it have a personal meaning, or is it just the fact that it's full of truth? And
well, it is really that it's, you know, it's based on Luke 2:14, and I'd found out about Charles Wesley and Whitfield, and it's right. just the words about it talks about the incarnation, which you know, a lot of carols don't sort of probably mention that in quite the same way, but yeah, it's just really that it's all full of truth.
Yeah, it's very uplifting, isn't it? I've noticed yeah. on my carol book now it says Charles Wesley and others. I'd never noticed the "and others" before. Mm-hmm. And you say one of them was Whitfield, and they didn't always get on, did they? Am I right? Wesley and Whitfield didn't always get on, or something?
No, I don't think they did, actually.
Yeah. Theologically, I mean, I don't.
Yeah, that's right.
Beating each other up. But,
didn't one of them believe in predestination, Whitfield, and Wesley didn't? Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. They stumbled over one of those major controversies
yes.
between them.
But, yeah.
But great that they could combine with something like this. Yeah. Okay, well, thank you. Yes, so it was right to push me. I hope somebody else has not got Hark the Herald Angels Sing. That's a variety. Christine.
Right. I need to put mine off till later because I've got a very lively, loud puppy here. So when he calms down, mm-hmm. I'll do my bit.
Okay, let's hope then that Sally is ready to come in now. Yes, hi.
Yes, so I chose O Come Emmanuel. Mm-hmm. You know, I just think the words are very beautiful. Yeah. It was originally written in Latin, and it owes its origins to monastic life in the 8th and 9th centuries, when monks used to chant the great Advent antiphons in lead up to and in anticipation of Christmas Eve. And then I think it was in 1851 that the priest and hymn writer John Mason Neale translated these and published both the 5-verse Latin version and the first English version, which became the much loved carol, O Come Emmanuel. And I actually didn't know till I researched it that Neil also wrote the carol Good King Wenceslas. But I'm not so fond of Good King Wenceslas. Wenceslas. I am very fond of O Come Emmanuel. And so, you know, it goes, O come Emmanuel, and ransom captive Israel, that mourns in lonely exile here, until the Son of God appear. Rejoice, rejoice, Emmanuel shall come to thee, O Israel. O come, thou Lord of Jesse free, thine own from Satan's tyranny, from depths of hell thy people save, and give them victory o'er the grave. Rejoice, rejoice, Emmanuel shall come to thee, O Israel. O come, thou day spring from on high, and cheer us by thy dawning eye. Disperse the gloomy clouds of night, and death's dark shadows put to flight. Rejoice, rejoice, Emmanuel shall come to thee, O Israel. O come, thou key of David, come, and open wide our heavenly home. Make safe the way that leads on high, and close the path to misery. Rejoice, rejoice, Emmanuel shall come to thee, O Israel.
Oh, I don't know whether you muted. You muted again, Sally. That's it, is it? Because you finished.
Yes, I've sang the whole of it.
Yes, okay, good. We didn't quite get the last syllable, I don't think. It's straight off. But thank you. Thank you very much for that. That always sends tingles down me, actually. And I just love the reference to Israel as well, rhyming it with Emmanuel. It sounds so good. I have very strong memories of that. I was at Durham University for my maths degree, and Christmas sort of began with the procession in the cathedral. I suppose it was Nine Lessons and Carols, or at least a version of that. And that was the processional hymn as they came in. So it started in the distance and they came up. And I remember one year I was chosen to be one of the candle bearers and had to sort of process down there while that was being sung. So, and they actually made a recording of that whole thing one year. In those days, it was a big vinyl thing. And so I used to play that a lot, and that was always the opening. And as you say, sort of without it being drowned with music, it was just the voices. It was very, very special. So thank you for bringing that one. Christine looks as though she's still preoccupied, so she's shaking her head. I think that's fine. Did anybody else have anything? Doesn't matter if you don't, in which case we'll save Christine perhaps towards the end. I've got two. They're not carols though, and one of them is definitely the end for reasons that become obvious when we get there. But I'm going to pick up the theme of songs. I'm going to read a song to you and then talk about it, lead into a little study, really, which we'll all do together, biblical thing. But I wonder if you actually know what it is I'm reading. Okay, here we go. As long as deep in the heart the soul of a Jew yearns, and towards the east an eye looks to Zion, our hope is not yet lost. The hope of 2,000 years to be a free people in our land, the land of Zion and Jerusalem, to be a free people in our land, the land of Zion and Jerusalem. I've got a hand up. Someone's coming straight away. And you know what it is, Alison?
Hatikva. It's our national anthem.
It's Israel's national anthem. It is the Hatikva, the hope. I'm going to actually put it up now. So if you're not familiar with it, that's what I was just reading out. Read it yourself, have a look at it again. And then I've got the Hebrew above it, just for those that like to see a bit of Hebrew, we might look back at it. But as long as deep in the heart the soul of a Jew yearns, and towards the east an eye looks to Zion, our hope is not yet lost, the hope of 2,000 years to be a free people in our land, the land of Zion and Jerusalem, to be a free people in our land, the land of Zion and Jerusalem. Good.
Paul, that's so lovely. Is it possible you could put the tune up? Because the tune is really beautiful.
I never thought to actually find a clip of it, I must admit. We can do that. Maybe someone else can Google and find it, but we'll certainly do it. I was just going to point out a bit of Hebrew for you. If you look at those words, are there any Hebrew words there that you recognise that you can match up with the English? This is just a little extra linguistic exercise. And if anybody in the opening here actually say, oh, yes, that's obviously this word.
The call is the voice.
Zion.
Well, yes, there's Zion, so there's Zion, yeah. Cole?
Yes, Cole's voice, yeah.
Yeah, where does that come in, as long as deep in the heart, then?
Well, it's a it's kind of a loose translation.
Yeah, yeah, okay.
I mean, Nefesh Yahudi Homiya is the soul of a Jew yearns.
Yeah, Nefesh is soul. We've talked about soul in the past, soul and spirit. Mm-hmm. Nefesh, Yahudi, referring to of a Jew. I don't know that word, but you're right, it must be yearns.
It is yearns. And Mizrach is east.
Right.
Kadima is forwards, or going forwards.
Right.
That's towards. The Ayin is I. To yeah. Zion.
Yeah, because that's one of the letters. So that's I, and obviously we've got that's I. And that must be, looks to, yeah?
Yeah, I guess.
Yes. Yeah, and there's the word hope, which I'm going to talk about in a minute. Well, there's the word hatikva, which is, I'll bring this up a bit more, the hope, hatikva, and that must be our hope, tikvatenu. What else is there that we can see? There must be Eretz, yes, the land of Zion and Jerusalem, Eretz, Zion, Yerushalayim. So that bit's fairly obvious. I don't personally recognize any other words from there, but good. Okay, has anybody Googled and found it to play it, or shall I try and do it? By the way, I discovered that you can display the chat at the same time as sharing the screen. It did come up, but I think we knew it anyway, but anyone?
Yeah, I've got it for you.
Okay. So, are you okay with sharing it?
I'll try.
You know you're meant to click on...
share screen.
Yeah, but also share, before you actually do share, there's a thing at the bottom about sharing the sound and optimizing the thing. There's two more little boxes at the bottom.
Oh.
Can you see them?
Oh, I've got share screen, but...
Okay. So has it come up what you actually want to share?
Yeah, I've got it ready to play.
Okay. Well, give it a go, but we might find we have to go, but I don't know what happens if you don't click those boxes. Just give it a go, see what happens.
Okay, I'll share screen.
Nothing yet. No? Is it not coming? If you're not managing it, Malcolm, don't worry, we'll find someone else or...
Oh,
We've finished, have we? Done it, Malcolm? You've gone mute. I think that's probably why we've stopped hearing it anyway. Anyway, we heard it all the way through and a bit more, so thanks.
It's a Moldovan tune.
Moldovan?
Yes, a Moldovan folk tune. They all used. Right. They took something from the old country along with the pine trees.
All right. Yeah, I did try and look something up. It must have been adapted by this guy. Music by, but from somewhere, I suppose, and Samuel Cohen, and the lyrics by Naftali Herzimba. Somebody. Good. Well, I want to focus our thoughts on hope, tikvah, and we'll share a scripture or two in a few minutes. That's our main sort of study thing. But I wanted to kick it off with asking you a question and opening it up for you to share if you feel that you want to, because before we're going to talk about hope, we're going to talk about disappointment, the opposite of hope. If you want to share this, the question is, what's been the greatest disappointment that you've ever known, and how did you combat it, or how, with God's help, did you overcome it, or whatever, or just any sense of how disappointment has... I mean, for some people, life itself is a whole disappointment. You know, they live their life full of going from one disappointment to another, I guess, or certainly a lot of ups and downs, so you get all these disappointments as part of it. We are meant to be people of hope, as we're going to think about, but we're still not, we can't avoid all disappointments. And maybe at some point you've hit a really big one and you've got something to share about how you came through it or what God did to help you in the midst of it. But if it's too personal, I will understand. But does anyone want to talk about disappointment from that point of view before we look at any scriptures? Well, you're a disappointing lot then. No contributions. All right, fair enough. That's just the way to get you thinking. Oh. Okay. We've got a hand up now. Yes, John or Jan.
Okay, well, some of you know the great disappointment that we're going through at the moment. Our daughter's marriage collapse.
Right.
And how we're getting through it is day by day and great WhatsApp trails of conversations and trusting God and hoping he'll come up with somewhere for Andy to move to quickly so that Christina can leave the house safely for Christmas.
Yes, I did pick up those messages that came through there. Yeah. So that's a very recent one and a very poignant family one. Yeah.
Struggling to see quite how God's going to be glorified in this.
Yeah.
So we tend to see these things a lot better in hindsight.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. You can't belittle these things, that's for sure. Sometimes it is only in hindsight. You're right. Angie, your hand's gone up, I think.
I just wanted to empathise with you because in 2018, our daughter's husband decided he didn't want to be married anymore. She's not walking with God, but it was a very hard time because he left her in the middle of a house renovation. And we had a Christian couple who we still pray with them every week, and they were good and they helped us pray together about it. And Ruth's come through this situation and we forked out the money to help her buy her husband out of the house. And she's, bless her, she's trying desperately to pay us back, which she doesn't really need to, but you do what you can for your kids. But it's just, I can see that God's been on her case. And although she wouldn't say she's a believer, odd things happen, like she couldn't find her keys. She'd searched through her handbag three times. And then she texted me and said, have you been praying? Because I've just looked in there and they were there that time. So God does little things, but God has helped us through. I mean, it was devastating. You think your daughter's married and she's going to be happy for the rest of her life. But, you know, things have moved on. She's got two kids. Harry's now 10 and Poppy's six, and you think about them as well. You want to protect your grandchildren, but just keep praying and trust that God will bring it round right. And she's okay, and she's met somebody else, and he's a much better father to the children than her first husband was. So it's hard. Yeah, it's hard. It was all I could think about for Anne John as well when it first happened. It knocks you for six, but just hung on to God in it, and friends prayed with us, and he worked it out, and it came round right. So just to encourage you, it's not easy. It's the worst thing that could ever happen, and it's, you feel desperate, but God's good, and he'll bring her through.
I guess the most intense disappointments are those that involve people and relationships, and obviously they're closer families, and the stronger things were, the worse it feels afterwards, you know, if you see what I mean. So, yeah, and Sally's saying thanks to both of you for opening up this little discussion on things. Malcolm, you want to say something? Oh, there was Wilma as well, I think, but Malcolm first as you're unmuted, and then Wilma, I think.
When Sheila died 8 years ago at Christmas, it took me a long time to start sobbing. And I'm talking about 2 or 3 weeks.
Yeah.
But then I was filled with the joy of the Lord, and I've been like that ever since. I mean, I still miss Sheila desperately after 56 years, but I've just got the joy of the Lord, and I thank him for it.
Thank you. Thank you for sharing that. Is it Wilma then? Want to say something? Can you unmute then? That's it.
Well, I think our greatest disappointment was that we didn't have any family. It caused a lot of pain. But then we eventually adopted two boys, and it wasn't easy either. We wanted them young so that they could grow, you know, so they could grow up with us. However, God just paved the way for us to adopt these two boys, because we weren't going to adopt a second one because the social worker, she had put her foot down, but we already had a social worker of our own, because we had been fostering, and she knew us, and she knew that we had three quite difficult cases, and she put in a word for us. She put in a word for us, and she was quite shocked when we were turned down the second time. She went to see this woman and ask her why she had stopped it, and she says, "Oh, why would anyone let their child be brought up in the Salvation Army?" I don't know what she thought the Salvation Army was. She was a Church of Scotland lady who went to church, but I don't know what she thought of us. Anyway, our social worker said to us, "You wait, in a month, you'll be on that list. Someone will drop out and you'll be on that list." Well, within a week, our names were back on the list. And that could only have happened with God's intervention. And so we have two boys. And, one of them can do car. He's done car mechanics. He's done gas work. He's done boiler work. And the other one, he's given us three grandchildren. So God is good. So it's not a disappointment anymore at all. Yeah, but not just for the reasons that they're able to help us in that way, but just the very fact we've been able to bring them up.
And thank you very much. And it was good that you got an encouraging word from the lady that was there. You know, you need someone to come alongside and speak into situations sometimes, even if it's just a bit of encouragement and reassurance on things.
Oh, yes. Yes, it was.
Sally, do you want to share something now? You got your hand up, Sally. Are you there? I think Sally might have frozen. In which case, I'll go to Jackie. And Jackie, then, as Sally's...
Oh. Yeah, I don't want to go on for too long.
Yes. Well, I just...
Are you there, Sally? Because we're still struggling to hear you. In fact, she's gone altogether, hasn't she? Someone's disappeared.
She's gone altogether.
Yeah, she's gone altogether. She'll probably come back. Sorry, Jackie, carry on.
All right. Yeah, I was just going to say, I don't want to talk for too long. The huge, enormous disappointment of my life was the breakdown of my marriage. And the fact, I think, above all, that I couldn't therefore give my children the home life that I really wanted them to have with a mother and father who were there in unity, etc. I married my husband twice. We were divorced. He became an alcoholic. We were divorced. Myself and my children then became Christians. I thought I always had been, but I wasn't. We all became Christians, prayed for him. He then became a Christian. He was totally delivered of alcoholism. We got married again, and then that should have been the happy ever after. It wasn't. He then had an affair with someone in Romania when we were involved there. And so it all fell apart again. So, you know, huge, huge disappointments. And I would like to pretend that I sailed through it, trusting God in all things. I can't pretend I did, but there was no way I could let go of my faith. Well, in fact, possibly I did. I remember I had a very wise friend who, when I said to her, "What do you do when you can't hold on to God anymore?" She said, "You let go and you let him hold you," which he did. Oh, yeah. And, you know, over a period of time, hindsight's a wonderful thing. When I look back now, the Lord has brought me through many things. Well, many things that have been difficult, but I don't think any experience in life is ever wasted by the Lord. And I've been able to stand with other women who've been in, you know, very similar or even different situations. And I love that scripture that talks about we comfort others with the comfort with which we have been comforted by God. And now, you know, I would never be doing the things I'm doing now if it had all worked out well. I would never have got as involved with, you know, Israel, the whole thing. I'm, you know, teaching groups and, yeah, loving doing that. And so I can see an awful lot of good has come out of what was so sad and very, very painful.
Thank you. But while you were talking, that Footprints poem thing came to mind when you said about letting go because he held on to you. Yes, when you look back and you find, no, he was carrying me as only one set of words. We've got Sally back. Come, have another go, Sally.
Yes. I don't know what happened there, but anyway, just to follow on from what I was saying previously, it was what Andrew and Wilma were sharing that prompted me really to share what I'm about to share. But I would say, you know, that I was very disappointed in my childhood, and I hate to have to say this now, but in my mother, because she always disliked me, and she told me right from as far back as I can remember that she hated me and wished that she'd never had me. And so, you know, when I eventually came to the Lord, there was a great big hole in my life, you know, where my mother's love should have been but wasn't, you know, and I just had this, you know, yearning for a mother's love. And I remember some years later when I went to Bridge Lane Christian Fellowship in Golders Green, I made some lovely friends there, but amongst them was a lady who was a lot older than me, but there was just such an immediate rapport between us, you know, and we had such a very strong friendship, but it was much more than a friendship. She turned to me one day and she said, "Sally, I consider you my daughter." And then she told me that she and her husband couldn't have children of their own and that I was like a daughter to her. And I just burst into tears because she was like a mother to me. You know, and I called her my mother. She had he said she had two spiritual children, myself and a lovely Iranian lady whose name is Cody. And, you know, she introduced us as her daughters wherever we went. And, you know, I just thank the Lord for this dear and lovely lady. She went to be with the Lord in 2011. Mm. Her name was Marianne. I think some of you might know her. I think John and Rose might remember her, certainly. But, you know, I just want to thank the Lord for bringing that dear lady into my life. And she yeah. actually became to me, you know, the mother that I never had.
Yeah. Thank you. It's wonderful, that great story. And if people can be the biggest disappointment, then they can also be the greatest encouragement and reversal of things as well. That's what we need. So maybe if anything else, we're learning that we've got to try and be there for people when they are going through these things. I want to turn to some scriptures, and I just wonder if, therefore, you can think of any great disappointments in the Bible. It doesn't matter if you can't, but presumably common experiences, they're all there in the scriptures somewhere, and we're meant to learn something from it. So I want to take to Luke 24. So if you find Luke chapter 24, which for me has got the saddest, most disappointing verse or collection of words in there. And sometimes, if you're not careful, though, you can pull out bits of scripture and it's wonderful to explain them and so on, but they can still seem a bit trite. But this is a very powerful story of two people on a journey along a road, the road to Emmaus. Picking it up from verse 13. So I'll share my thoughts on this, but do come in with some of your own. But this is still the first day of the week. It's that same day. It's still Resurrection Day. But there's two people trudging 7 miles, probably back home to their little village 7 miles away from Jerusalem. A slow walk at the end of the day. There's two people. One of them we know his name, Cleopas, perhaps also the same as Clopas, who gets a mention. And the other one may well have been his wife. That's the best sort of guess. And his wife, who is also mentioned in another place, Mary, the wife of Clopas, was one of those who stood by the cross of Jesus. So if it is his wife, then she was there at the crucifixion. That must have been a time of great sort of disappointment, as we'll see in a minute. And as they're going back home towards the end of the day, they're talking, they're discussing. It's always good to have someone with you when you're on a walk, particularly when it's a sad walk. It's not an easy journey. There's a physical journey going on here, but there's going to be a spiritual journey, an emotional journey as well. And I say, I can imagine that this was a slow trudge home. And the three words that really come home to me in verse 21 is where they say, obviously a bit later in the story, but their expression is, but we had hoped. We had hoped. And that always strikes me as being a very sad, depressing verse of almost absolute hopelessness. Three terrible words, a haunting sort of phrase of absolute desolation. They're going home bereft of all the hope that they used to have, which was he was the one who was going to redeem Israel. And what a hope that was. He was the hope that they all had. This was the one who was to come. He was the Messiah. And when you've had the greatest hope of all, when it's suddenly snatched from you, then that must be the greatest disappointment, the greatest disillusionment of it all. Absolutely crushing. And you can imagine what was going through their minds at this point, that it was, well, did we get it wrong? You know, we thought this was him, but maybe not. And how can we ever believe this again? This is a once in a lifetime thing. If it's not him, well, who else can it be? And I don't want to go through it all again anyway. I don't want someone else to come along and look as though he's the Messiah, only to feel once again let down by this. So all their hopes were dashed at this point. You can almost imagine them saying, well, we're going home, but for what? You know, what are we going to do now, sort of thing? We'll go back to our routine. We'll start another week. We'll do the usual sort of things. But what's the purpose anymore? Where's the vision? It'll just be back to something far worse than we knew. Once you've had a great hope and it seems to have been snatched from you. How do you cope with that? Well, what happens, of course, is that Jesus himself takes control. And it might sound a bit trite, but the point really is that Jesus knows about these things and he always has a way of coming alongside and helping. Because suddenly, you know the story, they're walking, talking, discussing these things, and Jesus comes and walks with them, but they don't recognize him. And we usually say that two's company, three's a crowd, but this is a case where definitely not true, the opposite. And like we were saying before about other people suddenly becoming important. They didn't notice who it was, maybe because it was getting darker, maybe he had a shawl over his head, maybe they just weren't looking carefully. Maybe Jesus was able to sort of make sure that they didn't recognize him in some way. But I want you to notice how gently and patiently he comes alongside them, where he just asks a simple question to start with. What are you talking about? What's going on? What's in your hearts at this point? And they stand still, their faces downcast, and they say, well, don't you know what's been happening here? And Jesus just says again, prompting gently, so what things? Tell me about it. What's on your heart, I think, is what he's actually wanting to know here. Just, he does know, of course, he knows everything, but please just express it to me. Tell me what's going on in your heart. And sort of picking other bits out of the story, jumping ahead a little bit, but the word heart is so important in this story, if you remember, because eventually, as the story develops, he's going to say, well, you were slow of heart to believe all that the prophets have spoken. But once they realized what the big change was, were not our hearts burning within us while he talked with us on the road? So Jesus was coming in at a heart level. Now, in those days, I'm sure you know that the heart was the place where you did your thinking, not your feeling. Your feeling was down further down in your bowels of compassion, as I say, but you thought in your heart, that was where your thinking was. But it's just an expression anyway, in that sense. But they were slow in their hearts. They were slow to believe, but slowly, if you like, they warmed up through being with Jesus, even though they did not know and recognize him and so on. Just the fact that he'd come alongside, he was beginning to bring them out of their hopelessness and he was going to change their hearts. He was also going to open their eyes. And three times in this passage, the word opened comes up. And that's the whole chapter because there's a mixed bit to the story afterwards. But eventually their eyes are opened when they do recognize him. And then they say, were not our hearts burning with us while he talked with us on the road and opened the scriptures to us. And then later on with all of them, this is verse 45 towards the end of the chapter, when they've gone back to the other disciples and he's with them all. He opened their minds so that they could understand the scripture. So Jesus was going to be opening things to them, their eyes, their hearts, their minds, and to a greater understanding of himself and to the scriptures about himself. It's interesting, it says, beginning with Moses and all the prophets, explained to them what was said in all the scriptures concerning himself. Makes me wonder how long he took. What a great this journey, and they soon approached the village, but somehow he managed to pack it all into that sort of short time. But eventually he was going to open all their minds, the minds of all his disciples, to the scriptures so that they would know more about him from the law, the prophets and the Psalms. And I've always thought, oh, I just wish I was there. I wish he'd opened my mind. That'd be a wonderful experience. But of course, what he was really doing, I think, was helping them to catch up on all the things they had seen and heard and experienced, but they hadn't grasped and they couldn't grasp it at the time. So now he was beginning to unfold things to them. And I think we do have all that sort of stuff there because it's what eventually was written in the New Testament by these disciples who wrote the Gospels or wrote letters and so on. We've actually got the outcome, the outworking of Jesus opening their minds to the scriptures and learning more about who he was. So we can share in that to some extent, but obviously not in quite the same sort of way. And we get to the end of the day, it's getting dark, They've approached the village, and Jesus acts as though he's going on further, but of course, hospitality won't allow that. They urge him to stay, at least come and have something to eat. And so it's when he's at the table with them and he takes bread, he gives thanks. We know what he will say. Blessed are you, O Lord, our God, King of the universe, who brings forth bread from the earth. He breaks it, gives it to them. And these two, Cleopas and presumably his wife, they weren't at the Last Supper, but they must have seen Jesus break bread, give thanks on other occasions, no doubt. Perhaps they saw him when he was feeding the crowds or at other times. Maybe that meant something. It brought back a memory. Maybe they saw his hands more, or they just saw his face more. Something enabled them to recognize. And immediately, of course, he disappears. And you might think, oh, that was disappointing. And if I'd been there, I'd be saying, oh, what's happened now? Where's he gone? Why is he gone? Start to sort of try and analyze the whole thing. But actually, they don't. Immediately, they get up and go back to Jerusalem. So somehow they're not bothered about the fact that he's disappeared. That hasn't bothered them. That hasn't worried them at all. But they now got hope again, and they've got something to share. So they go dashing straight back to Jerusalem, another 7 miles. No doubt it's now dark, but off they go because they want to share what has happened to them. They've been completely transformed by Jesus coming alongside them in this particular way. And of course, when they meet with the others, what do they find? Everybody else is saying, yes, we know it's true. We've had the same experience. The Lord has risen. He's appeared to Simon. And they could share their experience and how Jesus was recognized by them when they broke bread. And they started to share together. And then, of course, Jesus appears again. No questions about, well, where did you go then? How did you get here? How did you get here so quickly? And all that sort of thing. They're just delighted that he's back there. And as we said, he opens their minds even more. So I think this is a wonderful story of a journey of two people in absolute hopelessness, where this major, major hope that they had centered upon a person who it all seems to have gone. Messiah should not have ended up like this. And he comes alongside and he takes them on this extra sort of journey until he can open their minds on that. He had appeared to them in their doubt, unclear to them, but he came alongside them. And now in their faith and joy, he comes alongside them even more to teach them even more and so on. So I'm going to explore this little word hope again in a moment, but anyone else want to make any comments upon the passage or anything that I've just said, John and Rose?
Yeah, we hadn't seen that before, I don't think, but it's amazing how you skip over things and they don't bring full intensity. They would certainly, I mean, it was all uphill back to Jerusalem as well as being in the park.
Yes.
But okay. I guess they probably arrived in half the time that it took them to go down.
Yeah.
The remark, well, I'm thinking about it in a different kind of way. It's about remembering. It's another remembering. And God is always about remembering this and remembering that, and the instructions to the children of Israel that they need to teach their children and remember what God has done for them. And if they hadn't been aware of the scriptures, they wouldn't have cottoned on to what he was explaining to them. So yeah, they did remember, and they had that memory, and they knew what God had done, and they now linked it in, because Jesus linked it for, helped them to see the linkages, all the different things where he had been active, very active indeed, in the scriptures. So
and particularly it's the been things,
a remarkable occasion.
Yeah, particularly the things where about him suffering and then entering into his glory. That was the big missing piece for them, wasn't it, in terms of the Messiah? So he was joining the dots. You're quite right. He would say, like, you know this, but now you know this, but. So, yeah, he was making those connections for them. Thank you. Is there anything else on that, John? That's it for now. Thank you. But, yeah, you're right. We do miss little details. Sometimes three words just stand out and it makes a huge difference to the way you look at a passage. Anyone else? Malcolm?
I'm just remembering that when they didn't recognise Jesus as they walked along the road, what David Pawson used to say was, it was because their eyes were full of tears.
Yeah. Yeah. Quite possibly, yeah. And when it says they were downcast, I almost think maybe their heads were down anyway, because if you are downcast, you do trudge along like this, don't you? And, you know, you're not sort of welcoming. At least they didn't push the stranger away, but they probably didn't sort of, you know, go and sort of hug him or say, you know, oh, great to see you and all the rest of it. They accepted him coming alongside them, but perhaps they weren't looking very closely at him. So, Jeremy?
Sorry, I was quickly trying to check the Bible, because I in the Old Testament, it says that they plucked out his beard. And so was thinking, and this has been pointed out, I think, that if someone shaves off their beard and you're not ready for it and you see them in the street, you can have a double take and wonder exactly who it is.
Yes, indeed.
That might have been part of it.
I never thought about whether his new body had a beard or not, I must admit. So thank you. But yes, part of bearing the humiliation for us. Yeah.
And the other sort of heartfelt thought about it was really that hope deferred makes the heart sick. But hope realised is a tree of life. And that goes for life, doesn't it, as well, where we've been disappointed. And having just looked at Isaac Watts, and the poor man only reached, I think, 5 foot tall, perhaps because of his father being in prison when he was born and all that he went through. And he had a large head. And the love of his life, or the one that he's intended, loved the jewel, but wasn't impressed by the casket, as they say. So his personal life was sad, and he suffered psychiatric difficulty.
Yeah.
Made it through to age 74. And you just think, you know, what that man went through.
Yeah.
And so sometimes our hope realized takes a while.
As I said, some people seem to have a life full of disappointments, and probably say, well, you know, that sums up life for me. You know, that I'm going to come back to the hope deferred thing, I think, in a minute when we look at the word perhaps a bit. Anybody else, any comments at this point? Either on the passage or... in what you shared before, I mean, no one is underestimating how bad these disappointments can be, but we do know that Jesus always will come to us, and he will want to engage with us, and he will want to, in the end, through the scriptures, through the word of God, bring us back, and obviously just through his presence generally. So this wonderful word, tikvah, meaning the hope, probably know it's not the same as our sort of English version of hope, which is a bit sort of wishy-washy, like I hope it'd be a nice day tomorrow, or I hope things work out, or I hope this happens, and so on. A good sort of Hebraic definition of hope is actually an expectant waiting for a desired outcome. Now, when you said hope deferred makes the heart sick, yes, it does, if you're expecting your hopes to be fulfilled immediately and you've got the sort of wishy-washy English sort of version of hope. But in a true biblical sense, there often is a need to wait, but you're waiting expectantly because you know it's going to come. It's your desired outcome, and you have to wait for it, but hope will go through that process of waiting for it. Hebrew, as you know, the words come from other words, and the root of tikvah is kavah, which means to gather together, or it can also mean to wait and to hope and to bind together. And as you know, abstract concepts, often in Hebrew thinking, you need a physical concrete example. So it's like twisting threads together to make a cord, so that what hope does is that it has strands, and as it builds together, it becomes stronger, more durable, longer lasting, and is far better in the end than a single thread. So this idea of it taking time sometimes for a hope to be manifest or to really work out. So hope in the Bible and Hebraic thinking is linked to waiting, and sometimes the words for waiting and hope can be used interchangeably or together anyway. Have a look at Psalm 130, verse 5. Psalm 130, verse 5. I can't find it myself quickly enough. I think it's a lot of times when the psalmist might talk about hope, but this is one. Okay, then a minute. Psalm 130, verse 5. Yes, I wait for the Lord, my soul waits, and in his word I put my hope. Now, you know, this is in parallelism, so the two things go together, probably one building on the other. I'm waiting for the Lord, my soul is waiting, and in the meantime, in his word I put my hope. And then it goes back, my soul waits for the Lord, more than the watchman wait for the morning, more than the watchman wait for the morning. O Israel, put your hope in the Lord. And so on. So hope and wait often go together. In Isaiah chapter 40, the verse about, you know, when your strengths run out, and, you know, it talks about soaring like eagles, running and not growing weary. It's those who wait on the Lord, but also equally those who hope on the Lord or in the Lord. It's Isaiah 40, verse 31. Well, it starts at verse 29. He gives strength to the weary, increases the power of the weak. Even youths grow tired and weary, young men stumble and fall. But those who hope in the Lord will renew their strength. But it could equally be that those who wait in the Lord will renew their strength. Maybe some translations put it like that. I don't know. But you could almost exchange them, because it's part of that hope is you have to wait for a while for it to come. There's a very famous passage, a couple of verses in Hebrews 6 on hope, talking about hope as an anchor. So it's Hebrews 6, 18 and 19. And of course, the anchor is Jesus himself providing that hope. So what we've got in Hebrews 6, 18 and 19, it talks about in the middle of the verse, we who have fled to take hold of the hope offered to us may be greatly encouraged. We have this hope. The hope really is that it's impossible for God to lie, that God does not change his mind, that he has promised something, he's confirmed it with an oath. Basically, it's his covenant. We have this hope as an anchor for the soul, firm and secure. It enters the inner sanctuary behind the curtain where Jesus, who went before us, has entered on our behalf. That's our hope, that Jesus is death, resurrection, ascension, and he's taken that into the heavenly places on our behalf. And the idea of the anchor, which is solid and secure, but it's also tied to a rope or chain maybe, but it's that idea of the strength within that, and that we hold on to it that way. And I'll give you one more verse, which is less well known, but if we had hoped are the three saddest, most depressing words, probably in life, not just in scripture. Three of the most positive are in Zechariah chapter 9. And I'm sure you read Zechariah quite regularly. But again, isn't it easy to miss out three little words and lose an impact of something? Zechariah chapter 9, it's obviously to do with their return anyway, from exile and so on. But chapter 9 and verse 12. Zechariah chapter 9, verse 12. Return to your fortress, O prisoners of hope. Even now I announce that I'll restore twice as much to you. That's a great promise. But return to your fortress, O prisoners of hope. You may think, I don't like the idea of being a prisoner, but if there's one thing that I wouldn't mind being a prisoner of, that is hope. Let hope imprison me, if you like. I want to be chained to it. I want it to not let me go, and I'll not let it go. I want to be inseparable from hope. I don't mind being a prisoner of hope. And in our case, that hope is Christ himself, his death, his resurrection, his return, our salvation and everything. Whatever our journey, whatever our disappointments, we should be prisoners of hope. So there we are. We've ended on a very positive, hopeful note. Anyone want to add any further comments on this? And then it looks like Christy might be able to do her carol, and then I'll finish with another short item. But any other thoughts on anything we said, or just on hope generally? It's a wonderful word.
Mind that God's timing is perfect, which is not the same as our timing.
Yeah, which is why you may have to wait. But hope does wait. It's an expectant waiting. It's not a, oh, I've got to wait, or waiting can make you go in one or two directions. I think it can either cause you to abandon hope, or it can actually build up your hope. So, Alison?
I think hope is related to being able to live. So as a doctor, sometimes you saw somebody who completely lost hope. I remember somebody being told that the lesion she had was a secondary from her cancer, and she was dead in the afternoon. She was on the ward. She wasn't well, but that was the final straw.
If you give up hope, you give up life, the will to live sort of thing. Yeah, 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 exactly. And maybe even those two on the Emmaus Road together. What is there to live for now when you've had that hope? You know, look, what are we going back to? What's life going to be like now? We can't imagine what it must have been like waiting for the Messiah all that time, feeling they've found him, he's come, only for it to end like that. But Jesus didn't leave them like that very long, did he? Others had gone to the tomb and begin perhaps to have some hope. Well, it's empty, but they were still puzzled by it. They weren't sure. It took Jesus to explain it, which is what he will do. Right. There's no more hands at the moment. So, Christine, you've got a carol then.
Yeah, I have the same carol that Sally picked, O Come, O Come, Emmanuel. And it's been a favourite of mine for many years, the words and the music going together so well. I went to look for it in my Oxford Book of Carols.
Yes,
today.
I did, and it's not there.
It's not there.
No.
It's the content that's a bit too controversial for them, I think.
I wonder, yes.
Yeah, but when you said at first, you don't have to sing your carol, just read it out. At first I was disappointed, then I thought, no, you get the words and the meaning of the words much more when you read them than you do if you're used to the tune and it carries you away. Now, I did enjoy your singing, Sally, and so did Theo. He stopped and listened. But what I found very moving was reading out the words, and I'd like to do that now.
Please. Yes.
It might end up being a duet. We'll see how we go. O come, Emmanuel, and ransom captive Israel that mourns in lonely exile here until the Son of God appear. Rejoice, rejoice. Emmanuel shall come to thee, O Israel. O come, thou Lord of might, who to thy tribes on Sinai's height in ancient times did give the law, in cloud and majesty and awe. Rejoice, rejoice, Emmanuel shall come to thee, O Israel. O come, thou rod of Jesse, free thine own from Satan's tyranny. From depths of hell thy people save, and give them victory o'er the grave. Rejoice, rejoice, Emmanuel shall come to thee, O Israel. O come, thou dayspring, come and cheer our spirits by thine advent here. Disperse the gloomy clouds of night, and death's dark shadows put to flight. Rejoice, rejoice, Emmanuel shall come to thee, O Israel. O come, thou key of David, come, and open wide our heavenly home, make safe the way that leads on high, and close the path to misery. Rejoice, rejoice, Emmanuel shall come to thee, O Israel. And in When I was researching it, I came across a very interesting site. I'll try and put the link into the chat, because it talks about the hidden theology within this, which is very interesting. So I shall now see if I can post that into the chat or not. Chat to everybody. It's a long link, so you'll just need to click on it to get there. But if that doesn't work for you and you want to look it up, just look up the hymn and then hidden theology and it should come up. Paste. Oh, I think I'm going to win. Oh, there it is. Yes, hidden theology and history.
I haven't got a chat message yet.
Oh, because I haven't pressed enter. There you go. No, that's the missing
thing. You'll get used to this Zoom thing one day, Christine, don't
worry. I will one day, yes. Mm.
Okay, so maybe people can copy that and save it for later. If it's a long, it's a long article. There's a lot in it, is it?
It's not that long, not as long as some of the others were, but it was very interesting.
Okay.
Yeah.
Thank you. Well, before we go, you can either save it or, as you say, just Google it again, because that would interest me. Certainly, I'll have a look at that afterwards. I've always said that a song is worth singing. Well, it's a hymn, carol, any song is worth singing if the words by themselves are meaningful without the music.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a good test of whether a song is really worth worth it. Sometimes the songs are carried along by the tune, but actually what you're singing perhaps isn't quite as wonderful. Mm-hmm. And in our small groups, when we're thinking, well, how can we worship? You know, because we don't have a music band there. Great. Mm-hmm. We just encourage to sort of bring a hymn and just read it, just like you've done, very expressively, mm-hmm. very creatively, if I may say, using that word. Mm-hmm. And you can get the point, which is what the hymn writer probably just had in mind. He didn't probably never tune in mind anyway, any hymn writer.
Mm.
He was just, you know, producing these great words and things. So thank you. Anybody else got anything? Or shall I do my final little song then?
Sally has a hand up.
Oh, sorry, yes, you did. Thank you, Sally, yes.
Yes, I just wanted to follow on really from what Christine was saying. You know, she read out the whole of that beautiful carol and I sang it, but then I realised that there was another verse which I think Christine and I both left out. Ooh. And I'll read it this time. It's the last verse. It says, "O come Adonai, Lord of might, who to thy tribes on Sinai's height ancient times didst give the law, in cloud and majesty and awe. Rejoice, rejoice, Emmanuel, shall come to thee, O Israel."
Yes, it was there, Sally.
Sorry, that's actually the first line is different, but the rest is the same as verse 2.
I see. Okay. So you got it in a hymn book somewhere then, Sally? And
surprise, surprise.
Praise, I've got it
in Hymns of Faith.
It's not in Sankey.
Oh. Dear, dear. Well, this won't be in any hymn book either. And I had to leave it to the end because you can't really do anything serious after this. But the new Christmas number one has been released early and I've got privileged access to it and happy to share it with you all at this point. So sit back and enjoy. Thank you, Jeremy, for the extra on the beard. I'm going to try and share my screen again and enjoy this. You can let me do this. Here we go.
Oh.
Oh, his suit has been pressed, the sleigh's looking pretty. He's got the go-ahead from Professor Chris Whitty. Santa Claus is COVID secure.
We had this on Facebook.
Yeah.
When he enters your house, he'll be a good chap. He'll check himself in on the NHS app. Santa Claus is COVID secure. He's not displaying symptoms, you've got nothing to fear. 'Cause he isolates at the North Pole 364 days a year. It's close to midnight, the church bells chime. He's late because he's washed his hands a billion times. Santa Claus is COVID secure. He's got new rules to follow, it's a difficult task, but he won't go down your chimney without wearing a mask. Santa Claus is COVID secure. Presents are loaded, the drop-offs are mapped, his mince pies are all individually wrapped. Santa Claus is COVID secure. His sleigh is ventilated, the presents are as well, and Rudolph's had his red nose rubbed in antibacterial gel. The reindeer are velt, the elves play the part, they've all placed themselves 2 metres apart. Santa Claus is COVID secure.
Oh, great.
Thank you, yeah. Oops.
Thanks, Paul.
He's going the rounds now, is it, I gather?
Yes, I think it is. I've seen it on a number of occasions. Yeah. Somebody posted it on our WhatsApp group.
Yeah, very good. A song for our times, eh?
Yeah.
Right. So this is it. Nothing next week, and obviously the next couple of weeks after that. Back on January the 6th. And I'm going to start by looking at some aspects of the Bible, particularly get back to something very much sort of biblical, and maybe also eventually one or two items of spiritual warfare, but looking at sort of how we combat some of the things that cause us problems, perhaps, and what else comes up in the next couple of months in January and February. So that's it for now, folks. Have a great time, whatever you're doing.
And, well, thank you, Paul. I hope you have a well-deserved rest.
Yeah, I'm shutting down for a few weeks generally, and those things are stopping. So, anybody else want to have a final comment, or can you stop the recording then, Christine?
Oh, that's a good idea.
Yeah. By the way, all those of you that shared, you know.